This is our agenda for our salary pension trust meeting. I'd like to start by checking if there is any. I wanted to structure this similar to the way we do our board meetings and check if there's any audience participation that is for any public comment for the first few minutes of the meeting, and then we'll launch into our agenda. So, Camille, is there anybody who wants to provide public comment?
We have one community member attending, and I'm not seeing that they would like to provide public testimony.
Okay. Excellent.
Christina?
Yes?
Christina, can we Stephen is not on yet, so
Oh, okay.
I was gonna send him an email.
I don't think Ian's on either. He just emailed
Oh.
me.
Okay.
Camille, do you have Stephen's cell phone number? Are you able to text him?
Yeah, I'll do that right now. I'm emailing Ian right now as well.
Thanks, David. I just saw your email.
Oh, you're welcome.
It would be only me.
Yeah. While we're waiting, did everybody get the invite for the May meeting? I think I
Yes,
said
thank you, David.
Yeah.
Okay.
And thanks for reminding me that I wasn't ready to start the meeting
Somehow, David, I thought that was a re-invite for this meeting, thinking that was going to help me connect or something.
That was my first thought as well.
Sorry.
Okay, so I see Stevens in now, and so we're just waiting for Ian. Oh, there's Ian. Excellent. I think we have everybody here now, right? We have Stephen, we have Ian, we have AJ. Okay, yep. Thank you again, everyone, for being here and for rejoining our Salaried Employees Retirement Plan meeting. And I wanted to start with audience participation. I just wanted to indicate that if you want to provide some testimony to our committee to please raise your hand and let us know. Or if you want to make a comment via phone, press pound nine on your phone to raise your hand that way. Just wanted to check one more time, Camille, if there's anyone who wants to provide any public comment before we begin our meeting.
No, there is not.
Okay, thank you very much. So I'm
Christina,
going to
can I make a comment? I just want to maybe for the record indicate that it appears that Kalina's comments at the ATU meeting carried over to this meeting. So I just don't think there's a need for her to have testified twice, but I do want to make a note that Kalina did speak about both the ATU employees being able to take a loan, and she also referenced the non-represented from ATU. So just hopefully for the record, Stephen did volunteer to be part of that. So if his role could be to represent both sides, that would be great.
Excellent. AJ, do we need to make a motion, or is it just sufficient for that you've provided that as the public record?
I don't think we're going to vote on anything. I think Stephen volunteered and then
Okay.
information brought back for us to make a decision. But I just wanted the record to show that Stephen is representing both sides. And Stephen, if you're okay with that, based on Kalina's comments.
Sure.
Thank you
Thank
again,
you.
Stephen.
Not a problem. You owe me a latte.
Okay. So I think we were going to have Valak, but we will not be having Valak at this meeting today because of complications with the weather. And so the next thing I would like to move to is whether or not everybody had a chance to read the minutes of the November 19 meeting, and if anybody has any changes to those minutes.
I read them and they looked accurate to me. So whoever transcribed them, fine, fine work.
Thank you, Stephen. So the next, we'd like to make a motion on this.
I'll move to adopt.
I will second. All in favor of approving the minutes to the November 19 meeting?
Aye.
I as well. AJ?
Sorry, couldn't get off mute. Aye.
Thank you. All right, moving on. We have the report from Ian on investment and the excellent performance for this year as well as for the fourth quarter. Is there anything different that you'd like to share, Ian, from the excellent report that you provided to us in the ATU meeting?
No, maybe just a couple just differentiating comments just for the record. So, you know, plan performance was similar across plans, up just shy of 15% for the 2020 year. I think the key difference here obviously is just the difference in plan values. So I'll just state these for the record. And we had a beginning market value of about 20.8 million. We had about 560,000 in paid out net cash outflow. So benefit payments and expenses. We had a gain of just north of 3 million for the year, which left us at 23.3 million or so for the year. So the rest of my comments should be consistent across the plans, but just wanted to note the differences in basically the actual cash amounts.
Thank you, Ian. That's great. 3 million per increase is awesome. That's a great gain. So thank you so much.
Thank you all.
All right, moving on to the report of the actuary. I believe that we had a conversation last time that the actuary was going to provide some information on whether this plan is on target and give us any risks and mitigations that we might want to consider. Lacey or Scott, would either one of you like to speak to this topic?
Yeah, we'll get started, and I'll actually share my screen here and confirm that that everyone can see that. You should be seeing a kind of presentation with a blue cover right now. Okay.
Yep, looks good.
All right. So we'll cover a couple things today. Shouldn't be too long here, but want to both give an update on sort of the estimated funded status and where we're at in the cycle, similar to what we discussed in the ATU plan. But then we'll spend some time on kind of responsive to the point from the last meeting about general sort of projected trend for this plan, given that it's closed and what that will look like going forward and sort of risk factors to keep in mind. No action items today, but more for background and education, and then can be a jumping off point for further discussions the trustees might want to have at later meetings. So as a reminder, valuations are done every 2 years. The most recent one was the July 1, 2019 valuation, published a little over a year ago now. So we'll be doing, kicking off our process later this year for doing the July 2021 valuation, and then that will set contribution rates for upcoming plan years and financial reporting as kind of mapped out here on slide one. Slide two shows both the last three kind of formal valuations with liabilities, actuarial value of assets, which is a smooth asset number, and then the unfunded liability and funded status for the last three published valuations. And then the rightmost column here is kind of an off-cycle estimate. So 18 months through the 24-month period between valuations, So that's, it's just for discussion purposes. That's not really a proper measurement date for this plan, but to get a sense of what the good 2020 calendar year returns have done, we wanted to focus on the, you know, as shown there in July 1, 2019, the funded percentage on this basis for the plan was about 67%. And then with the good returns, mainly in 2020, but for the 18 months sort of intervening from these two dates, that's actually bumped up to about 76% on the salary plan. So similar story to what we, you know, discussed on the ATU plan. We'll obviously see what the next, you know, the following 6 months are as far as asset returns and incorporate that in the measurements that, that we do, you know, more formally later this year. And at that time, we'll also reflect experience over the two-year cycle as far as pay increases, retirements, mortality experience, all that stuff, and have a, you know, sort of the formal measurement of the July 1, 2021 that we'll be discussing at meetings later this year. And please do jump in with questions on any of these as we go if trustees have them. So slide three, sort of stepping back from a specific estimate at a point in time, it's important to remember any valuation that we do, any actuarial valuation, is based on a single set of assumptions. And while it's very important that those be reasonable assumptions, we also know actual experience will, you know, never exactly match that experience. Easy to think about this with investment return assumption. If the current assumption is 5.5%, as was shown on the prior slide, even if that is exactly the right assumption over a long period of time, it's going to vary year to year. And in reality, it's, you know, it's not going to be spot on over any particular period of time because of the fluctuations that happen there. Same thing on other demographic assumptions and so on. So because of that, it's important to have not only good, reasonable assumptions as a starting point, but a structured process to adjust as you need to going forward. Remembering that in the middle of this page, what we've discussed with the trustees before, sort of the fundamental cost equation for a pension plan, is that the benefits that are defined by the terms of the plan, plus any expenses needed to operate it, have to be paid from two sources, essentially: contributions made to fund it, and then the earnings on those contributions. Out of those things, contributions are the balancing item. You know, you have some influence over earnings just through asset allocation, but you don't really get to govern what those are. You know, if we got to, instead of set an assumption about what those were, if we got to decide what those were, we would have a much higher recommendation than we usually come in with, right? We have to take the returns as they are, and then contributions have to adjust to be able to fund the benefits for the plan. As we've discussed in, you know, the prior valuations and contribution setting meetings, the current contribution policy is split into two pieces. One, what we would call a normal cost, which is the cost of ongoing new benefits being accrued by active participants. That is funded as a percentage of pay over what's now declining payroll, since this is a closed group in this plan. It has been for some years. So that's paid as a percentage of pay on an ongoing on the active population. And then the second piece is an amortization payment for any shortfall because the plan is less than 100% funded. That's a level dollar amortization that has been paid over a declining period. Started originally at 20 years when this was introduced, when this current kind of structure was introduced. And then at the most recent valuation is down to a 12-year period where that shortfall is being amortized and is being funded. So that's kind of the structure that we have in place. And so thinking of next couple slides here, we'll sort of say where we've come from and where we're going as far as demographics of the plan and maturity of the plan. So this plan has been closed to new entrants in the defined benefit piece of it since the beginning of 2012, as shown here. This chart is a bar chart of headcount split between active, what's shown there is VTE, so that's a vested terminated participant, someone who's left but hasn't yet started their benefit as of the particular measurement date. And then the light blue is in payment, so retirees or beneficiaries in payment. And what you see is that, you know, it's fairly steady with the active population hovering in, you know, 80s to 90, up until between 2011 and 2013 is when the plan closed to new entrants. And so from then, there's no new actives coming in, and actives can only kind of go out into one of these two buckets, either deferred or in payment. And so we've seen over the last, you know, decade or so, significant trend down to where by the 2019 valuation, we had 35 or 36 actives, I think, at the time. And the sort of light bars here to the right are just running out our valuation assumptions about how this may change over time for 5 and 10 years out, roughly. And so we're going to continue to see that active population dwindle down. At the end of 2030, it might be something closer to 10 active participants if everything kind of goes according to assumption based on where current actives are. So it's going to be a very much a predominantly inactive plan within a decade here. We're already majority inactive as far as headcount. And slide 5 shows this same dynamic, but with a different metric, which is really plan liabilities over 2001 to 2019, the yellow being the percentage of the overall measured liability that's active, and the sort of blue-green here being inactive, so both the deferred vested and the in-pay folks. So the split there was 70-30 active to inactive at the start of this period. At the end of the period, it was still about 70-30, but reversed. So it's now 71% inactive at the most recent measurement date. This is expected when you close the plan, like this isn't a problem, but it's something to be aware of, and it's a natural course with a closed plan, and it's something to then keep in mind for future contribution structures and future sort of balance of risk, the different risk exposures for the plan. So most prominently, the normal cost contributions are going to continue to decline and eventually be no more once the last active retires. Contributions for amortizations of any shortfall, any gains or losses, that'll still exist at least until the plan gets to 100% funded. So, you know, depending on how that goes, that could sort of sunset and eliminate if the between investment returns and the contributions being made, if the plan gets to 100% in the near term, that could could get to a spot where you're overfunded and there might not be a shortfall contribution while there still is a normal cost, but it could also continue long after there's a normal cost depending on actual experience of the plan. One important point noted in here, I mentioned before that the current amortization period is 12 years and declining. So as we get to where that's declining to a very short period, we're gonna wanna work with the trustees to see what is sort of the good ending steady state. Eventually, if this plan continues to operate, continues to have investment risk particularly, you may not wanna have essentially a 1 year amortization period for the variation that could occur there. And so there's kind of it's good to keep drawing this shorter and shorter to get the plan funded up to 100%, but there may be an end point here. That's already contemplated some in the funding policy, but it's gonna be sort of bringing the specific implementation of that back to the trustees in the next couple valuation cycles, really. So I mentioned it's not unexpected. I mean, what we would call the maturity of the plan, the getting more and more inactive heavy was anticipated, and it's what should be happening here. But it does make it more difficult at times to respond to poor experience. It's not a perfect analogy, but you can think of sort of an individual retiree or participant saving for retirement in their 40s versus in their 60s or 70s. You need to make some different choices to make sure that you're in a position to respond. Plans can have an analogous sort of trade-off and cost benefit to consider. So these next few slides, Lacey's going to walk through some of the specific risks that we always kind of have a summary and discussion of this in our valuation report. If you look back at the most recent one, there's a little longer, more verbose version of this, but we wanted to bring some of this to the trustees as a starting point, and then certainly can respond to questions or any other thoughts that come out of it. So Lacey, you want to jump in?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. So in particular, today we're going to talk about three kind of groups of risk, investment risk, demographic risk, and liquidity risk. And I'll just start off by saying a lot of this might sound pretty familiar because this is not new information. This is stuff we've been talking about at meetings for years. So I'm not expecting any surprises here. This is just a summary for everybody so that we have the same starting point for having these conversations going forward. So first, we'll start with investment risk, which I'm sure is very familiar. Just the risk that investment returns actually experienced by the plan are different than what we expect. And like Scott mentioned, they are basically always going to be different from what we expect. We're never going to see a return that's exactly the assumption that we have set for the valuation. However, again, with that, the balance equation that Scott mentioned, when asset returns typically are lower, then you would need to contribute more to the plan, so it can have an impact on the funding. With the last valuation, the trustees selected an investment return of 5.5%. And this is really common with plans over the last few years. They've steadily come down in the assumptions. This plan has dropped from 8%, I believe, to 5.5%, mostly in the last few valuation cycles. And we'll look at the data, I think, on the next slide, so you can see the pattern of that. The actual returns for the plan's asset over the last 19 years, we have 19 years in the chart, has been 3.9%, which sounds very low, but keep in mind that that includes the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009. And like Ian mentioned this morning, when we look at the last 10-year period, that's in the recovery since the crisis. So that return has been closer to 7.6% just in the last 10 years. And again, as Ian mentioned, for 2020 has been even higher. As everybody knows, it's very variable from year to year. And also, we wanted to mention that as plans mature, like this one, again, that's not intended to be a negative thing. This is very normal. But many plans will choose to structure the investments differently than when they were a less mature plan. And this is where we might start to see a shift in the assets where the salaried plan could be invested somewhat differently than the ATU plan. At this point, they're roughly equivalent in the allocations towards equity or fixed income. But since the ATU plan is open and the salaried plan is closed, it may be appropriate at some point to start changing the allocation there. One way that we commonly see plans handle this is what we call a glide path, where the investments are shifted in stages as the plan's funded status improves, so that you're, in a sense, locking in the gains or the funded status before shifting into less riskier assets. Scott, can we go on to the next slide? So here's the data that I was talking about over the last, I think we have 19 plan years. As you can see, it's variable from year to year. Things can go up or go down, which again, everybody's familiar with that. And that return, the expected return has gone down from 8% to our 5.5% assumption, which is something we review with every single valuation. So when we have those conversations later on this year, that assumption is something that we can review again based on what the equity markets look like for this year compared to what prior years have looked like. So the next risk that we want to talk about is demographic risk. And this may be one that is slightly more unfamiliar, but it's the risk that our assumptions about the demographics of the plan don't, that actual experience is different from expected. So this includes mortality, when active members retire, when VTEs retire, and other what we call decrements in the valuation. So a decrement would be an active member terminating, retiring, or potentially dying or becoming disabled. Those are all things that we model in the valuation. And when real life goes differently than the valuation projection, then you have a difference between the expected liability and the actual liability. we base those assumptions as best we can on the experience of the plan, but especially things like termination and retirement, those are very individual situations. And so those can be wildly different sometimes than what we were expecting. As an example, for the 19 to 20 plan year, which included the beginning of the pandemic last year, we were expecting 3 or 4 people to move from active status to retirement status. In reality, I believe we saw 9 or 10 retirements during the plan year, not necessarily just because of the pandemic. Those could have been folks who were just ready to retire at that time. But that's an example of where the actual experience of the plan shifted significantly from what we were expecting to see in the plan. The reason something like that matters is the plan has what we call early retirement subsidies. So the value of your benefit can be different if you choose to retire at 55, 60, 62, 65. The amount of your benefit changes, and the amount of the benefit is what drives the liability. So if someone retires with a larger early retirement subsidy than we were expecting, that can have a significant impact on the liability of the plan as a whole. The other risk we wanted to mention here as part of the demographic risks is longevity. I'm sure that's something that is more familiar. That's something we talk about pretty frequently with our mortality assumptions. But if, as a whole, plan participants live longer than expected, benefits are paid for a longer period, which again increases the liability of the plan. So overall, what we would see if folks lived longer, we would refer to that as an actuarial loss in the plan. The liability is increasing more than expected. So this is something, again, we measure each year, or each valuation every other year, and we're comparing the actual experience to what we were expecting and adjusting those assumptions as needed to make sure that they remain reasonable given the data that we have for the plan. The last risk we're going to talk about should also sound familiar, and that is liquidity risk, or the risk that the assets have to be moved from the investment side to the account, the cash account that Sarah and Dean used to pay benefits earlier than expected, and potentially even at a loss. We've talked at length about the negative cash flow status of this plan, meaning that contributions are less than benefit payments and expenses paid out of the plan assets. And again, this is a very normal pattern for a mature plan like this. It's not something to be concerned about. It doesn't mean that the plan is running out of assets. It just means that where the assets are held may need to be adjusted in order to continue to pay benefits. You've seen this with transfers from the investment account to the cash account. That's something that may need to be reviewed more frequently by the trustees to ensure that the cash account has enough money to continue paying all of those benefits to the retirees and to pay the occasional expenses that come through as well. I think we have a pretty well-established system of reviewing this at quarterly meetings, but it may be worth looking into setting up a plan for the trustees to make those decisions about transferring assets from the investment account to the cash account between meetings as well, because you don't want to get into a situation where the delay in transferring money prevents a retiree from being paid. I don't think we have had significant issues with that, but as more people are in retirement and there are more retirees to be paid each month, it's another issue to be aware of and make sure that you have a comfortable procedure in place for handling those kinds of situations. Ian probably can speak to this more if he'd like to, but I don't believe the current asset allocation has a significant amount in illiquid assets, meaning assets that would be really difficult to liquidate and then transfer. So that isn't a big concern for this plan. And in the past, it seems it's been fairly straightforward to make sure funds are transferred from the investment account to the cash account. I think the next slide. Oh, Ian, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to agree with you that, yeah, we, and this is something that we also visit annually, and we will do that at our next meeting when we confirm the asset allocation for the preceding year. And liquidity is one of the key focuses of that. So this is actually a really great presentation for you all to think about as we go into asset allocation exercise next week.
Great.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Sure. Could you say that again? Over what period of time? Was it that 26 years the plants earned what percentage? Can you kind of just say that again?
Scott, can we go back to slide? Which one is it?
Slide 7 here, the 19-year history.
Yeah, so that has, the next slide has the chart with the individual data, but over the last 19 years, the plan asset return has been about 3.9% each year. And over the last 10 years, which again is in that post-crisis recovery period, the plan return has been about 7.6%. Does that answer your question?
It does, thank you. Perfect. I had missed that 7.6% and I thought we were only at the 3.9. That sounds a little bit better.
And if you look at the graphic here, and it's important to note some of these measurements, like if Ian came back with it for a similar period, it may be slightly different as far as our valuation results and measurements versus kind of the ongoing cash flow, but it's the same neighborhood, definitely. That particular 19-year period we're talking about, as you can see here, had both kind of the tail end of the 2000 and dot-com trouble in the markets, and then obviously the great financial crisis. So you've got that 19-year period, you've got that without any of the sort of good returns that came if you were to extend it to like a 25-year period. So they're always very endpoint dependent when you're cutting these kind of comparisons.
Thank you. That helps. Thank you.
Okay, Scott, I think we were, yep, that's the one right there. So this hopefully also looks familiar. We included a really similar slide in our presentation when we were wrapping up the valuation. This is looking at actual inflows and outflows to the plan for the last, I think, 10 years, and then looking forward, projecting where we think the plan will be on an annual basis for the next 10 years. So the blue bar are, the blue bars are employer contributions, so coming into the plan. You can see the extra contribution there that was made in the 2016 plan year. And then that help is expected to be fairly steady going forward, even adjusting for, like Scott said, the closed nature of the plan and having fewer actives. Eventually, the majority of the contribution is made of that UAL amortization piece and is less dependent on the actual actives who are in the plan. So that's why that looks pretty steady, even though we are expecting the active population to continue to decrease until all members are inactive, either deferred or in pay status. The lighter blue are the projected 10 years, and the darker blue are the last 10 years of actual experience. The green bars represent outgoes from the plan in the form of benefit payments and administrative expenses, primarily benefit payments. And so those have been, in the last 2 years, slightly larger than employer contributions, which puts us into that negative cash flow situation. What's not represented here are income to the plan for investment returns. So this is all net of investment. And again, this is nothing that we're concerned about. This is perfectly normal for a plan at this stage, but it is something to keep an eye on just to make sure that the plan has the liquidity needed to continue paying those benefit payments.
One more thing to keep in mind with this, as Lacey mentioned, investment returns sort of aren't shown here, but this is predicated on the valuation assumptions of 5.5% return each year. And so the math kind of all works if the plan is getting that 5.5% and benefit payments go like this and contributions as shown, then the plan still works its way to 100% even with a negative cash flow. Again, that's expected because of where the plan is. If investment returns underperform, then thinking back to that fundamental cost equation, contributions are going to go up, and the blue bars here, the employer contributions that are shown in sort of the projected period here, the lighter ones, would increase. And so then the plan would either have a smaller negative, smaller cash outflow or a positive cash position, depending on how much the adjustment was. But that's the dynamic piece here, is that if, whatever actual returns are will then govern where these employer contributions are in reality. And if they need to be, they'll increase and mitigate the outflow, again, to drive the plan to 100% funded based on actual reality. But this is sort of the projected if everything went right about assumption.
So, Scott, that means that we would only, or the LTD contribution remaining at the light blue line remaining at 1.1 million, and then the assumption of the 5.5% return, and that means it could change based on the glide path that you mentioned, right? Because the 5.5% return is assuming the current assets allocation structure.
Right.
And if I'm hearing you correctly, you're suggesting that at a certain point, we'll want to change that structure to have a glide path that is less, has less risk, which would have mean less return. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes. And that if that allocation changes and the forward-looking return assumption changes, it will change the balance here and mm-hmm. could potentially push the employer contributions up. If you're doing that in a way that is sort of happening as the plan gets funded, I mean, if we were to have another great year like 2020, which is not a great year in the broader context, but in terms of investment returns, if we were to have more investment returns like that, and so you get to a better funded status, if you were coming from that point, that would initially push the employer contributions down because you're recognizing better funded position. But then if you were to rebalance and lower the risk allocation in the portfolio and lower the expected return, then you'd nudge it back up. So the exact pattern of how you get from 5.5% to a 5 or 4.5 or 4 or whatever a different outlook might be with a different portfolio will depend on how you get there. But by itself, that lower forward-looking assumption would push employer contributions up. And so that's part of the trade-off of you know, how the asset allocation has changed, how quickly and how you get there.
So I guess given the most likely scenario in terms of us needing to, in probably the near future, shift, start doing that glide path shift, would you expect our employer contribution to increase, stay the same, or decrease? How much?
We don't have the how much because it would depend, and we can model this. May be something that's worth us bringing back for you know, next meeting or the next valuation results to portray a few different kind of patterns there. In mm-hmm. general, all else equal, we would expect it to go up in that scenario, mm-hmm. And that's going to be the pattern here. But this also does tie into sort of how the declining amortization period is stabilized as well. So we mm-hmm. doing a longer term projection of a couple scenarios and alternatives for the trustees to weigh would be the approach we would anticipate taking with this ultimately. So that there's a couple moving parts here as far as how to coordinate asset allocation and the sort of steady state amortization when you're planning for a, you know, a 10, 15, 20 year contribution profile. So I know that's not a specific answer to the how much today, but does that process make sense or?
Yeah, I guess one way of looking at it for me, if I'm doing long-term planning, is that my risk is about 5.5%, right? Because that's right now you're making the assumption. So I'm trying to figure out. Currently, we put in 1.1 million, and what would my risk be in terms of additional contribution to make up? And the what I think I'm hearing, even if with whatever glide path we pick, would be that the maximum, the maximum is not to have that 5.5 return on investment as we do the glide path that reduces our return.
Right.
Is that a reasonable assumption?
Yeah, I think one thing we could do that's helpful for you, or let us know if this would be helpful for you, but we could give you sort of a matrix of just for sensitivity of 5.5% equates to, you know, the current employer contribution. If we, at the most recent valuation, if we did that at 4.5 or 3.5, how much different would that have been? So that's sort of no other moving parts, but you could get a range of sort of how sensitive that kind of current steady state is to if we had switched all at once at the last valuation to those other rates. And then you could sort of at least draw a box around it a little bit for what it looks like.
Okay, that would be helpful. And one other quick question is when you mentioned transfer frequency, how frequent should we, at what point should we be looking at more frequently the transfer? Are you okay, or do you feel it's okay as it is today where we look at it every quarter with Dean and Sarah and figure out whether there is anything that needs to happen at that time?
That's a good question. I think, I mean, ultimately that's an operational question that, you know, Sarah and Dean may have, and Ian as well, for the mechanism of liquidating funds and transferring them, may have, you know, more detailed input than we do. I think it seems like quarterly right now is working fine. I guess two thoughts that I would have is that I certainly have some plans who they get to a spot where they just set up a steady state once a month. There's a transfer that gets liquidated and brought over. So it's happening ongoing month by month in smaller increments. And then still confirmed every quarter or every year to see if it's, you know, trending one way or the other. But that makes it, you know, more steady drips rather than once a quarter. So that's an alternative if that kind of worked. It would not be subject to trustee approval for every single transfer. It would be putting something in place that, you know, is sort of going until it's changed. I guess that's the other approach that I've seen that you could consider if that works operationally here.
Thank you. And Ian, is that a better from your perspective, from a portfolio perspective, is one better than the other?
I would say that, you know, I've seen plans do it a number of different ways, like Scott's mentioning, but, you know, the risk, kind of tying this all together, you know, the real, from investment side of things, the real investment risk is really twofold. Are you meeting your 5.5%? If you're missing that, that's your biggest investment risk, because that's kind of a loss on the year. The second part of that is has to do with liquidity. And because we've got a extremely liquid portfolio, you know, you're not holding any core real estate, you're not holding any private equity, you're not holding things that have lockup periods where you can't get capital back for a number of years. That's not something that this plan is exposed to. The portfolio is really very liquid, much more so than your, you know, your CalSTRS or CalPERS, for example, some of those bigger plans. So the liquidity piece of it has me much less worried here than in some of those other plans. So, you know, the risk of dripping out too frequently and is sometimes that capital can't earn anything in the markets, and with cash rates being essentially zero right now, you're also not earning anything in a checking account. So it can be a defensive measure. You know, that can be one way to install that more defensive glide path, if you will, is simply transferring more over more frequently. The flip side of that risk is it's not earning anything. So that's something that we need to continually weigh. I would think right now, just looking at it at a quarterly measure is working just fine, in saying that, you know, here's projected payments for the next couple quarters. We've already established, you know, in the past couple meetings, making sure we have some kind of a buffer. Like we want to at least have X number of months in payments available in cash at all times. And just making sure that we look at that every quarter, making sure that that's not trending up or down, and making sure that kind of policy is in place. I think that's prudent for right now. But if we got to a point and we're, you know, as this graph so accurately shows, you know, you will get to a point where you're going to be paying out more than contributions are making up. So it might get to a point where we want to increase that buffer, for example. But I think a quarterly look at it is fine for right now.
Okay, thank you. Does anyone else have questions? Yes, AJ?
So Christina, I think, you know, we might not do it for this first long-range financial plan, but mm-hmm. I would say by the next year one, mm-hmm. I think we really have to plan for that additional contribution. Whether or not it happens, I think we just need to plan conservatively in the long-range financial plan because that's a 10-year plan.
Exactly.
Yeah. So to me, I think maybe it's too soon to include it, but I would say we probably want to look at the timing of things and just take a real conservative approach. So mm-hmm. that if we do better than anticipated or our timing is better, you know, it's always okay. But I really would hate for the district not to plan for that additional contribution and then have such a high escalation in its personnel costs that it's not sustainable and the district then takes drastic steps because we didn't plan ahead. So I think this information is really key for us to plan, Christina. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, and I think that leads us pretty well into our little last wrap-up slide that we had here, Scott. And I think we've touched on a couple of these points already, but this is all just based on the last valuation that we completed about a year ago. A lot has changed, like we talked about, in so many ways since July of 2019. So with the next valuation we're completing later this year, it's a great opportunity to dig in a little further on a lot of these issues. We can do more projections of the plan, in addition to just refreshing the data that we have, which will give us a more accurate picture of where the plan stands now compared to where it was 2 years ago. But we can investigate things like we talked about, the impact of changing the asset allocation. What does that do to the discount rate? What does that do to our expected return on assets? What does that do to the liability, the funded status, the contribution level? Those are all things that we can investigate on behalf of the trustees, especially as part of the next valuation cycle. And the scope of that or specific scenarios are all things that we can talk about. But this is really a great opportunity to look into that to make sure that everybody has the best information possible for making those kinds of decisions. So this is another, like I said, just a great opportunity to look into those things further, depending on what the trustees want to see.
Thank you so much, Lacey. That was a really very helpful presentation. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Does anybody have any? Oh, Stephen has his hand raised. Stephen?
Thank you, Christina. And thank you, Lacey, Scott, for the presentation. I would like, Scott, you offered, and I think Christina's questions, along with AJ's, were addressing the welcome. We will welcome the sensitivity analysis. Speaking just for myself, I just want to see the exposure. So we're making a 5.5% assumption now. I'd like to see the sensitivity analysis at, let's say, 5, 4.5. I'm not so worried about the upside. The upside will take care of itself. That is probably the only thing that Donald Trump ever said that was accurate. You worry about the downside because the upside will take care of itself. And also to play with the little bit of the inflation assumptions, currently at 2.5, my crystal ball has never been good. But the one thing I think is a fair assumption is going forward, inflation is going to whip around a little bit. And it's been unusually low for an extended period of time. And if we believe in regression to the mean, it's probably trending higher over the life of this plan. So I would like to see some of the sensitivity analysis pull that component in. Because I definitely think it's not a question of if, It's just a question of when we need to be prepared to contribute more. I think AJ, of course, is spot on that we need to assume a more conservative, take a more conservative stance. Because the last thing we want to put the district in some future point is a really tough financial pickle. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. We'll work up some of the sensitivity, sort of initial starting point on that. We can do based on the last valuation, but then also leave that as a jumping off point for the work later this year with maybe a more robust spectrum with the latest and greatest information.
Thank you so much, Scott. Thank you, Stephen. The next thing I have on the agenda is the report of the attorney, Jeff.
Sure, okay. Let me see if I can share my screen as needed. Okay, hopefully, do you guys see, for some reason I can't ever see.
I can see your screen.
And do you see the First Amendment there?
I see the benefits to be paid retroactive to age 60.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Okay. With that rocky beginning, so the attached draft amendment is for review and possible adoption this meeting. The amendment relates to the employees who had their normal retirement age increased from 60 to 62 in 2009. We've discussed this at the last two trustee meetings. The amendment would add new section 8.14, 8.14.1 grants payment to certain former employees representing up to 24 months of benefits that they've already foregone due to the increase in their normal retirement age. And 8.14.2, let's see, does that move it for you guys? Okay, it specifies who gets the payments, and basically it's the vested terminated employees who have already turned 60 and who have therefore already missed out on some payments from 60 to 62. In line with the prior thinking from past meetings, the amendment doesn't grant any retroactive benefit to anyone who's currently younger than age 60. And I guess the last thing I'll say is that the amendment has been reviewed by Milliman. So between all of us, the amendment does what achieves its intended purpose of granting that retroactive benefit of up to 24 months for those who have already attained age 60. I guess that's all I was really intending to say about the amendment. It's got a lot of it's fairly complicated to draft. But it's not that complicated in concept. So I guess I would just stop there and see if you trustees have any issues with the concept that we're trying to achieve with this amendment.
This is what we've discussed last meeting, right, Jeff? The last couple we've gone over this, and this is just your legal interpretation of it, the legal wording of it.
Correct. My goal was to implement exactly what you guys sort of outlined at the last trustee meeting and the one in August to grant the retroactive payments to those who had their normal retirement age increased from 60 to 62 and who have already attained age 60 and so have already missed out on payments, but not to increase the benefit for anybody who's not yet age 60, who we can contact going forward.
Well, I just have one question before I'm speaking just for myself, but if your E&O insurance is in place, then I trust your wordsmithing.
Always good to have the insurance in place before you say that about my drafting, so.
And I agree with Stephen. I think this is what we discussed, and it represents paying only those that had reached 60 and not the other group of individuals. And we would be contacting them as per our discussion at the last meeting. So I'm supportive of this.
Thank you, AJ. So I will entertain a motion then.
Hold on just a sec, Christina. So just before we get to that, let me talk about the ways that this amendment can be adopted, because the plan allows for adoption of an amendment in two ways.
Okay.
And the first way is for the trustees to approve it and for AJ to sign it as general manager. And then at the next board meeting, AJ would present the amendment to the board and describe what the trustees have done. That's one way. A second way is for the trustees to approve the amendment in concept and for the amendment to go to the board for the board to adopt the amendment. So, you know, one is the first method is for the trustees to adopt it and sort of tell the board what you've done. The alternative two is for the trustees to approve it and recommend to the board that the board adopt it, but leave it to the board to adopt it. You know, for typical amendments, I'd say the general manager typically signs, but this isn't necessarily a typical amendment because it's paying an added benefit. And so I don't know what level of comfort AJ has in particular about alternative one, where she signs and tells the board what the trustees did versus telling the board, here's what we think you should do, but letting the board make that decision.
Let me weigh in on that. So under my general manager hat, my authority for total contracts, so whatever I would be signing, cannot exceed it has to be under $150,000 over the point in which I make the decision. So I cannot incur more than that under my general manager hat. My comfort level would be us approving it and this going to the board of directors so that the board of directors can approve it. And under their authority, then I would be authorized to sign under the general manager authority. But I think that's consistent with the authority that the board has given me.
And that certainly makes sense. I mean, in this case, the total value to all the people who would be getting a benefit here is under $150,000. So you, even disregarding the fact that this is coming from the trust, and I don't know how that fits in with your $150,000 authority. It is under the $150,000 authority. Nevertheless, I'm not saying at all that that means that you should use alternative one where you sign it as opposed to having it go to the board.
Let me ask you a question on that. So with the back payment, would be under $150,000, and there would be no additional cost incurred because of me signing that amendment?
Correct.
I think even though I may have the delegated authority by the board, it might just be prudent. It's good to know because the board may want to know why it's coming to them if it is under $150,000. But I think it might just be prudent to take it to the board in case there would be any questions by anybody, or this would be raised by any retiree about us making this decision because it is incurring cost to the plan. It would be good for the board just to have that level of transparency. So I think being prudent, even though I would have the authority, my comfort level, and I'll get Christina's input and Stephen's input, if they think that this would be a necessary step to take. I don't want to burden the board with any unnecessary steps, but it just seems like a prudent way to proceed, even if I do have the authority under my other hat. Scott?
So AJ, would this have to also go to the contract committee, or does it would it just go directly to the board in that scenario?
You know, it doesn't fall under the contract committee.
Okay.
Because we are the recommending party. Okay. And this is kind of more like the union contract doesn't go to that contract committee. It's personnel related, not services related. But so it doesn't need that additional step. We are that additional step during this process. But I do think it's an additional step to take despite the value. But any thoughts on that, Stephen?
Thank you, AJ. I appreciate the keeping in the fore the whole concept of being transparent. With due respect, I think I'd be quite comfortable with you signing this and us letting the board know that this was signed and why. I think it's not just an added expense. It is also, as Jeff explained to us during our last couple of meetings, it's probably an opportunity for us to potentially sidestep a legal landmine in the future if someone starts to scream. So I think it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do for the folks who this very particular amendment addresses. And so I would, again, feel comfortable with you signing it. David's eyes are on it, Christina's, Dean's, Ian, everyone here. So it's not like we're doing this in some dark corner and just advise the board of why and let them know.
Sounds like a plan. Christina, are you okay with that direction as well?
Yeah, that's I'm okay with that direction. So we would then be looking for a motion for AJ, for this group to have AJ sign this amendment to the plan, and then I will write up a document to be forwarded to the board to explain what we have done. Is that what we believe is the right approach, and that we want to make a motion to do that?
And I will move that, but my motion will be that we approve the presentation given to us by Jeff, and that I, under the general manager hat, sign it, and we notify the board. I don't know if you're the right person to write that up. I don't know if maybe the attorney can help us in drafting that. I think that would just be more appropriate, Christina, because
that would be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
And that is my motion.
Excellent.
And I'll second it.
Thank you, Stephen. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye, aye.
Thank you so much, everybody. Great discussion. I very much appreciate it. And Jeff, when would you be able to do that write-up for our board?
I can do it. When is the next board meeting? When does it need to be done? I can do it at, you know, whenever it's needed.
So our normal, normally our deadlines for the next board meeting is the last week of the month preceding the board meeting. So in this instance, that would be by, we're February 28th, I believe, would be the deadlines that we have for the meeting that we have in May. So we are responsible for providing Camille with our documents by February 28th for the board meeting that we have on May 19th.
Christina, that's actually February 24th. It's the last Wednesday of every month.
Sorry.
No problem.
February 24th.
So I'll have a draft write up to David by tomorrow.
Oh, perfect.
Can I ask a quick question, Jeff? I'm assuming Adobe Sign for this will be fine, or do we need AJ to sign a wet signature?
Either is fine. I'll send you a final amendment, and however AJ signs it is acceptable.
Excellent.
That's all I have.
Thank you. And I prefer electronic signature, although I'm available to sign. I can. I just always like the tracking of the electronic system better.
Yeah, I'll have Ashley put it in there.
Thank you, David. All right, so that we're getting to close to the end here. The administrator's report is next.
Okay, so I sent everybody the cash flow statement and the salaries and expenses since our last meeting. And as you know, we all just discussed, their retirees are going up. So we've had a few more and a couple lump sum payments. Other than that, I'll just open it for any questions.
No questions for me.
No questions. It was beautifully done.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. And thank you so much, Sarah, for that report. And the last thing is, if there's any new or unfinished business that people want to add to our agenda or discuss.
I have one suggestion, if yes, no one else please.
Is it. Go ahead, Stephen. If
we could come up with a system that saved maybe Ian time and David time and hence all of us time. I got emails from Ian with the quarterly report. Then David sent those along, and there's a whole bunch of emails. I get some from everyone here. Is there a way to centralize it so Ian's not sending what David is sending, or vice versa, and there's one location for us? David's email to me, which was very helpful, I think it had 9 attachments, which might have been a record for this week for me. And again, I appreciate they're all important, but I'm just wondering if we could, and I don't have a solution. I'm just pointing to not a problem, but I'm wondering if our process can be tightened up so there's one repository that we can all go to see this information instead of just getting a whole bunch of emails throughout the preceding week, 2 weeks to these meetings.
That's a really good point, yeah. Stephen.
And I can
sorry, go ahead, AJ.
Actually, Stephen, very timely that you mentioned this. I had notified, I think, and I'm hoping if everybody didn't get my communication, it would be great if all the material went directly to the clerk of the board with a copy to probably David Collier. And what will happen with that material is Camille uploads it. Well, first of all, she files it in a folder that follows Oregon records management system. And then she uploads it onto the website. And when it's all put together comprehensively, she sends only one email with the link. And the purpose of the link, not sending attachments, is to, some emails have trouble taking large files or multiple large files. So by sending the link, it's accessible. And even if you lose the link, you can always just go onto our website, look at the date of the committee and click on it. And all the documents are there for the public. So if Stephen, if that's doable, that could be the solution. And that way we all don't get separate emails.
That works for me.
That's a great suggestion, AJ. Thank you so much. That works great.
Do we need to copy Sarah on that or not?
It doesn't really matter. I can download them from the website. I'm okay with that. I usually keep all of the meeting materials and put them in our records as well. So either way is fine.
Great. So thank you, Stephen, for improving our process, and AJ for your suggestion on how to make it work. So thank you so much, everyone. We've already discussed the timing and place of our next meeting, which I believe is on May 11th, the Tuesday. So right following the ATU meeting. Is there anything else that people wanted to go over?
That's it for me. Thank you, Christina. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks.
Stay well. Bye. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye, all.
Bye.